Hello, and welcome to the Duane Morris Money and Banking Law Podcast with Joe Silvia, brought to you by the global law firm of Duane Morris. I'm your host, Joe Silvia. I'm a former Federal Reserve lawyer who represents banks, fintechs, and other clients on M&A, payments, and regulatory matters at Duane Morris. I'm also a core member of our banking, fintech, and digital assets and blockchain practices. The goal of the Duane Morris Money and Banking Law Podcast is to inform and educate our clients and friends on both the fundamental concepts and structure of the banking ecosystem, and also critical developments in the law and regulation of money and banking. On this episode, we're talking about bank mergers and acquisitions. So why talk about bank mergers and acquisitions? What's so special? What's so unique with respect to this type of transaction that does it really warrant an entire podcast? Well, while much of the process and even some of the mechanics are quite similar to traditional non-bank M&A, banks are highly regulated institutions with certain special characteristics that I think deserve some special consideration in the context of strategic transactions. In a more traditional corporate transaction context, for example, deals can be signed and closed on the same day. However, in the banking context, and in fact, most financial services contexts here in the United States, the signing of a definitive agreement is only part of the overall process. The transaction doesn't close for some time after you actually execute the definitive agreement. Why? Well, it's because there's a detailed and elaborate regulatory approval process that banks and other financial institutions need to engage in, whether it's applications to federal banking agencies like the Federal Reserve, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, or the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or applications to specific state banking agencies like the Illinois Department of Financial and Professional Regulation, the New York Department of Financial Services, Pennsylvania Department of Banking, and others. So with the understanding that bank mergers and acquisitions are somewhat unique in terms of transaction structure and timeline, what does the actual process look like? Well, the process isn't all that dissimilar from other corporate transactions, generally. You have initial discussions, a strategic kind of evaluation, initial due diligence. Then you talk about confidentiality agreements, perhaps an NDA is signed before you even find out particular levels of information at the target or acquiring institution. And then you move on to negotiating potentially the terms of a letter of intent or indication of interest, the preliminary terms for what may become a finalized definitive agreement. Letter of intent generally includes a few key components that will be discussed and outlined in the definitive agreement, but generally are drafted early on in a non-binding way to examine exactly how the parties view certain pieces of the transaction going forward. So, for example, some of the key provisions that you would typically see in a letter of intent, especially in the banking area, is, of course, key provisions regarding purchase price, right? Detail around the purchase price mechanics, detail around purchase price adjustments, whether the purchase price is to be paid in the form of cash or stock or some combination of that. And there's also provisions related to exclusivity or transaction structure generally, tax treatment for transactions. Again, confidentiality creeps back in here as well. Phase of due diligence, what timelines might look like initially. Then there's probably going to be provisions related to things like management and or employee matters. So employee benefits issues get dealt with kind of earlier on to make sure that everyone's on the same page as to whether or not employees are intended to be retained, whether or not that's to be determined, whether employee benefits continue or will be substantially the same post-transaction for the employees. And then unique deal features may be added to things like the LOI or intent to, indication of interest, excuse me. There's also going to be termination provisions, and then generally there's going to be some kind of provision that indicates that the letter of intent itself is actually a non-binding agreement or the provisions herein are non-binding, something along those lines with the exception of the confidentiality provisions. So once we have the signed letter of intent, lawyer's next step, at least, is to begin drafting the definitive agreement. To do this, we usually start with, some kind of template form, depending on the actual transaction structure, depending on the types of parties that are involved, whether we have holding companies, banks, what the structure of the transaction generally looks like. To help with this also is developing a signing checklist. And it's as simple as it sounds. It's developing a checklist that outlines exactly what needs to be done prior to and leading up to the signing of the definitive agreement. So not only do you have to draft the definitive agreement, but you may have some kinds of exhibits that you need to include. You may have certificates that need to be included, disclosure schedules, things like that, that need to be included on a signing checklist that need to be covered off on before the actual execution of the definitive agreement. So I mentioned the definitive agreement. What does it look like? Well, it looks like most other M&A transaction documents. It covers off on the structure of the transaction, the consideration for the transaction. You know, key points to keep in mind are understanding who the parties are. Sometimes I mentioned there's holding companies involved. Sometimes there's an immediate merger of the banks post-closing. Sometimes there's not. Sometimes you have merger subs, which are just a company that is formed for the purpose of executing the merger agreement itself. And for only that purpose, it's there for essentially a moment in time in many cases, done for tax and other reasons. Whether there's, like I said, single or multiple steps. So that's talking about whether or not everything is going to be closing on the same day, or whether you're going to have a closing for the bank holding company merger at the top tier, and then some delayed closing for the bank to bank merger below, if the banks are going to be merged. You also see contingencies and, you know, other kinds of issues that are going to be discussed and outlined within the definitive agreement, much like you'd see in other areas of the law. Sometimes the form of the agreement is a little bit different. Sometimes you have an agreement and plan of merger. Sometimes you have a stock purchase agreement. Sometimes you have something that's called a purchase and assumption agreement. And, you know, those are just different forms of a merger and or acquisition. So common structure, again, we have definitions, we have the transaction itself, consideration that's going to be paid, whether it's stock, cash, or some combination, reps and warranties, covenants with respect to especially pre-closing operations, regulatory filings and such. You got employee and employee benefits matters that are going to be discussed in the definitive agreement, closing conditions, especially regulatory and shareholder approvals, termination rights, breakup fees, and then you have kind of the general category that is the boilerplate language that we've all seen in the M&A context. With respect to exhibits, typically you'd see things like bank merger agreements or interim bank merger agreements, and you'd see voting agreements, non-compete, non-solicit type of agreements, perhaps employment agreements, and other kind of deal-specific exhibits. As you move through the process and you move towards closing, what do you need to keep in mind for closing preparation, specifically in the bank M&A context? Well, the most important piece is the regulatory application stage. And we'll talk about that in a minute because it's so unique to the bank M&A space. But you also need to cover off on shareholder approvals, whether there's been any changes between signing and closing, purchase price adjustments, post-closing matters, and then you start planning for the actual integration of the two companies post-closing. So now let's turn to the regulatory application phase. And so this is one of the key features of bank M&A transactions and one of the unique aspects to bank and other financial institution or financial services type transactions. You have the signing of the definitive agreement. You've put together a bunch of documentation that kind of outlines the transaction, what's going to happen, and so forth. Now we have a stage where we have to go for regulatory approval, whether to the federal banking agencies, state banking agencies, or others. In most cases, we're talking about banking agencies. So for simplicity, that's where I'm going to focus. So one question that comes up early on is, well, can we apply? Are we in a position to really apply and get approval? Are we in a position to obtain regulatory approval? Because the reality is that the federal and state banking agencies don't want to be approving mergers and acquisitions whereby, especially an acquiring bank, can acquire even if they are in either troubled condition or they have compliance or other components of their CAMELS ratings or compliance ratings or some other rating like a specialty CRA rating, AML, IT type of rating. But in those contexts, we want to make sure that we have satisfactory ratings for each of those components before we are going to go seek regulatory approval, really before you go and engage in discussions for a potential transaction. So next, where do we apply? If we've figured out that we're in good enough shape, we've got, you know, good ratings, we've got good management, good condition, where do we apply? I mentioned before, we've got Federal Reserve at the federal level, the OCC, the FDIC. We also have states. So for bank holding companies, you're going to the Federal Reserve. National banks and federal thrifts, you're going to be applying with the OCC, the Office of the Comptroller of Currency. State non-member banks, so not a member of the Federal Reserve System, you're applying to the FDIC and the applicable state banking authority. For state member banks, you're talking about not only the state banking authority, but also the Federal Reserve System as a member bank of the Federal Reserve System. And then credit unions, you're going to be applying to the NCUA, the National Credit Union Regulator, and then the regulators of the potential target as well, whether it's state or federal at that point. So there's multiple different regulators involved. There's multiple different applications, because what likely is happening in many cases is you have holding companies involved and you have banks involved. And so whether you have a state chartered or nationally chartered or federally chartered bank, it just makes the application process just a little bit more complicated depending on how many of the applications you actually need to complete. Each agency has its own form. And depending on the actual transaction itself, the form of the transaction, structure of the transaction, that will dictate what application form you actually use to apply to the agencies. So what are some of the things that we see in the applications themselves? What are we submitting to the federal and state banking agencies? Well, you're generally going to submit things like either an executive summary or a transaction summary that goes over the general terms of the transaction, why the transaction's happening, how the transaction came to be, who the transaction parties are, and so forth. Then you're going to also talk about the future prospects, right? Within the application, the purpose of the transaction. Are there new business lines that are associated with the transaction? Are there new geographic areas that made the transaction particularly meaningful for the acquirer? You know, what does an integration plan look like? What are some of the future ownership details looking like? The next most critical piece of an application to a federal or state banking agency is the financial projections. It's the pro forma financials. And typically we suggest, and the regulators expect, quite frankly, financial projections that are going out looking forward 3 to 5 years. Sometimes they ask for more, but that's a pretty good expectation going forward. So 3 to 5 years out from the closing of the transaction, what do the pro formas look like in terms of capital, asset quality, concentrations? Are there other types of unique pieces or unique expectations that need some additional notation in the financial projections? Included also within the financial projections that the regulators are going to look at with a fine-tooth comb are things like what the debt of the institution may look like going forward. If there is being, especially if there is going to be debt used for the acquisition, if there's some financing piece as a contingency to the transaction. Next, we talk about managerial issues. Okay, so there's sometimes forms that folks need to file that are part of the application, but they're called interagency biographical and financial reports. And so it's just like it sounds, it provides individual background and financial information on key management people, key management employees, officers, potentially new directors in some cases, key owners, principal owners of the organization. So managerially going forward, the regulators want to make sure that if we are rated appropriately and satisfactorily as a management, that that's going to continue to be the case. And that's going to continue to be the case even with this expansionary authority that we're acquiring, right? The geographic scope, new business lines, whatever it might be. We also want to look at compliance issues, if there are any at the target, for example, especially with respect to things like consumer compliance and AML compliance, that's anti-money laundering, countering the financing of terrorism, which is a separate subject for another episode, but want to make sure that if there are issues that we know of, whether they're public or, you know, we've become aware of them through other channels at the target, want to make sure that we address them in the application to make sure that the regulators appreciate that as an acquirer, we understand the issues, we understand how to remedy them if they haven't been fully remedied yet, and we understand how to make sure that those kinds of things do not happen again with the resulting institution in the future. Other things that are included in the application include discussions around the community's convenience and needs factors. So whether there's a particular assessment that needs to be done for the community to demonstrate that the community of the resulting institution, whether it's expanded or not, is in need of particular products and services, whether the products and services of the resulting institution are to fulfill that need. What do the Community Reinvestment Act examinations and ratings look like? Things of that nature, making sure that the community that in which we're going to operate as the resulting institution is actually going to satisfy the needs and the convenience of the community in which it will operate. Next in the application, we deal with competitive issues, right? So making sure that we're not creating some monopoly or competitive issue. And here it's interesting because in the bank M&A context, we don't really have the kind of application, depending on asset size and transaction value, we don't have the application that has to go through the HSR filing process. There's different types of criteria that we have in the bank M&A context where we use something called an HHI analysis and basically do a review for the particular banking markets in which the existing institutions operate in and in which the resulting institution will operate in to ensure that we don't have some kind of monopolistic or anti-competitive effect as a result of the transaction. Typically, more important type of analysis when we get to much larger transactions or transactions that have a highly concentrated area of banks and we have large institutions or a large institution making additional acquisitions. Finally, on the regulatory application piece, what do the timelines look like? Well, it's longer than you want it to be in almost every case, right? We start with potentially pre-filing discussions. So what are those? Those are simply conversations, not necessarily written correspondence back and forth, but verbal conversations over the phone, conference call, or in person with certain of the agencies to discuss the contours of the transaction and the contours of a potential application for approval. We go through, and after this pre-filing discussion, we've gotten some level of, I don't want to say comfort, but we've gotten some level of understanding as to where there may be additional requests for information or where we may want to front run that and provide additional information, whether it be on, you know, geographic scope post-transaction, meeting and satisfying needs of the community, financial issues, debt issues, or otherwise. Once you've applied, once you've submitted your application, which typically under the merger agreement we'll say has to be done within 30 days or so of the signing or the execution of the definitive agreement, once you've applied, there's a minimum in almost every case, minimum of 60 days, okay? Because there's a couple of different components. You need to publish something in the newspapers of general circulation. It's a legal notice. It's a couple paragraphs, very straightforward, but you have to publish that in a newspaper of general circulation in both the geographic area of the acquiring institution and the target institution. That allows the public to have an opportunity to provide comment on the application. Where there are comments from the public or from the community, that can very well extend the time frame because of the back and forth that's necessary to resolve some of those comments. In addition, with respect to the time frame, there's a lot of back and forth that will happen in most types of transactions, even generally plain vanilla transactions. There's back and forth with respect to sometimes missing information or information that's not quite clear to the examination staff that needs to be explained or addressed. Sometimes even there's changes to some piece of the acquirer or the target after the regulatory application has been submitted that need to be updated in the application. So once you get the approval, whether it's 60, 90, 180 or longer days after applying, then what do you do, right? Well, that the regulatory approval is the key component to finalizing a bank merger and acquisition. So after you get regulatory approval, you make sure that you have your shareholder approvals nailed down, done whatever documentation you need to around that, clear any kind of waiting periods. Typically, there's a 15-day waiting period for the DOJ to review applications once that approval is submitted. So you wait 15 days, which in some cases can be waived. But you wait the 15 days before you close. But in those days, again, you're checking off on shareholder approvals, making sure nothing else has changed. Do you need updated disclosure schedules per the merger agreement? Looking at what closing documentation needs to be taken care of, looking and reviewing your closing checklist that you review usually on a weekly basis, if not a day-by-day basis at this point. And look at what needs to be done immediate post-closing, right? Immediately post-closing. So what deliveries need to be made? What filings need to be made, whether they're with state secretary of state's offices for the mergers themselves or some other kinds of filings? Notice to the federal banking or state banking agencies after the transaction is actually closed or consummated. These typical post-closing notices are something that are not only included in closing checklists, but also critical pieces to finalizing the transaction and moving forward. Then once you do that, you move into the integration stage, which is similar to other types of transactions outside of the banking context, where you're talking about IT, operational integration, cultural alignment, you know, rebranding, and then after that is the ongoing regulatory reporting and kind of typical bank regulatory expectations for the resulting institution. So that's really the focus of the unique features of bank M&A or concepts of bank M&A. You know, there's a lot of it that's very, very similar to other types of corporate transactions, but there are key pieces, not only in the initial stages, in the LOI, the definitive agreement, and then certainly with respect to the regulatory approval process. There are key concepts and things to keep in mind to the extent that you are going to be engaging in some type of transaction that involves a bank or a bank holding company, or really any kind of financial services company or other financial institution. And finally, other kinds of M&A, right? It's not just bank to bank or bank holding company to bank holding company. Sometimes we're talking about branch acquisitions. Sometimes we're talking about technology acquisitions, holding company acquiring a non-bank institution, some things like that. Each of those types of transactions has unique features that need to be addressed as well. So suffice to say, if you are going to be looking at transactions that involve financial services companies or any kind of financial institution in the United States, you need to make sure you appreciate the regulatory expectations and also whether or not there's other statutory or regulatory pieces that need to be addressed in the specific transaction documents. Very, very critical, very important to be looking at those things and to make sure they're taken care of so that the timeline overall doesn't get totally screwed up and totally off track for what you and especially the client might be expecting. Well, that's all for today. Thanks for listening in. I hope you learned a little bit something more about bank mergers and acquisitions, and especially if you're a practitioner in this area. If you have any questions, as always, feel free to reach out to me, jsilvia@duanemorris.com, or to any of your favorite Duane Morris lawyers. Stay tuned for new episodes again coming soon. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.